What's up? It's Dawson Gamble, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Here's a big question for my listeners. If music didn't exist, what would humanity lose? What's up, everyone? Wishing you all a productive and enjoyable week. It's Gigi, CFRC's newest intern, and you're listening to CFRC Takeover about neurodivergence in the music classroom. We will be discussing how to accommodate and engage with neurodivergent students in the classroom, focusing on practical, inclusive strategies that support diverse learning styles, build trust, and foster a positive learning environment for every student. Now, I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Cheryl Bruce, adjunct professor at the Dance School of Drama and Music. Dr. Bruce, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. Please introduce yourself and your experience in the field of education.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I think this is a really important topic, and I'm glad that it's getting some airtime. So thank you for doing that. So my name is Cheryl Bruce. I am an adjunct professor at the dance school, and I'm currently teaching courses in community music and an introduction to music education. And I also work at the Faculty of Ed teaching theory and professionalism. So that's kind of my background here. I also spent about 15 years in high schools teaching music. So I think that's important to have that kind of background to be able to speak to what it looks like in the classroom and how that changes over time.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing. With that, we can just jump right into it. How do you define neurodivergence in the context of music education or in the classroom in general?
In music, I suppose that the definition is probably the same no matter what topic you're teaching. Mm-hmm. But in music, I think it's important to know that students learn and experience music differently. And that's true of all students, not just those who identify as neurodivergent. I think everybody learns and experiences music differently. So my kind of hot take on this, I guess, is that the term neurodivergence kind of implies that we're diverging from some sort of norm. But mm-hmm. I think that it's important to approach teaching as an individual activity. Everybody's coming at this from a different standpoint. And I think that music is highly contextualized and everybody experiences it differently. So if we think about it from that sort of standpoint, I think it means that everybody's learning and experiencing things in different ways, and we need to honor that.
I think that's really well said. Diverging from a norm. I really like that definition. Thank you for bringing that. What drew you to working with neurodivergent students in schools or other non-formal settings?
I don't think that it's something that you're necessarily specifically drawn to. I mean, I think that, like I said, you have so many different students who exist in a classroom that as a teacher, you kind of have to be able to accommodate for that. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I'm working specifically with so-called divergent individuals. It's rather that it's an important part of considering individuality in teaching overall. I think that this is something that exists in every classroom and that we need to be aware of and honor when we're creating lesson plans and thinking about individuality when we're teaching.
Mm-hmm. Definitely something that we need to honor and be aware of, especially going into this sector of work. Following that question, what drew you to working with kids, working in the field of education?
Well, that's a good question. I think for me, it was music itself and also the love of learning. Mm-hmm. It's something that I still love to do. It's something that I don't think I'll ever stop doing. And I think learning is so important, but it's important to find what speaks to you and what engages you in that process. So for me in high school, music was the safe space. Music was the place that I went to when I didn't want to be anywhere else, or even just to be with my friends and to be with people who had similar interests. So I went into teaching music because I wanted to be able to foster that same sort of safe space. I think that's really important to have. So yeah, I think that's what drew me to that career.
I think that's really lovely. I know I had a moment where I realized that teaching was what I wanted to go into. Did you have any sort of moment or epiphany that made you realize, yes, this is for me, this is where I need to be? Or was it kind of just something that you always knew?
If I'm completely honest, I didn't always want to be a teacher. In fact, mm-hmm. I sort of railed against that because I thought it didn't fully speak to my personality. I was, I think, a little bit scared of some of the challenges that come with teaching.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common with a lot of people who go into this field. I think what changed it for me was the experience of getting to know the students. Mm-hmm. So I started with teaching some private lessons. And in that sort of music space, getting to know someone really well, making those connections is really rewarding. Yeah. And I think if you can imagine that in a classroom filled with 30 or 35 students, that's rewarding times 35, right? Mm-hmm. So if you can even reach a few of those students, you're making a difference. And I think that's what was really important to me to imagine being able to create that space and create those connections and hope that maybe at the end of this, somebody's going to love music as much as I do.
Yeah, I think I could say the same. I also did not originally want to go into teaching, but I think for me, I was in a lesson with my piano teacher, and I really wish that I could remember what she said to me, what made me think this. But in that moment, I thought to myself, what am I doing? I've been teaching piano since I was 13 years old, and I was 17 at this point. And why have I never considered going into teaching? Well, I think I had considered it. I just thought to myself that it was such a big workload, and there's so much that goes into teaching, not just, you know, teaching a lesson. Like, there's lesson planning, there's students with different behaviors, there's IEPs, there's class management, there's report cards, there's talking to parents. It's just so much to think about. And I think that's why I put it on the back burner. But then I had that moment and I was like, I need to be a music teacher. That's why I'm here now. So I get having that and not quite being there in the beginning, but realizing that's where you need to go. Steering back to neurodivergence, why do you think that this topic, especially right now, is important in terms of teaching or music teaching?
Well, I think that we're more aware of differences right now. I think that's mm-hmm. kind of come to the forefront in research and in experience. And I think that it's sometimes something that we don't talk about when we're training teachers. I think it is more so now. But like I said, I think it's really important to consider how everybody's an individual. And I really think that's where we need to start with considering this is not as like a medical intervention. That's not what this is, but just realizing that everybody has different needs and wants and comes to music from a different perspective. And I think that neurodivergence kind of feeds into that. As we as music teachers go into the classroom, just keeping an open mind and being aware of what students need, I think is really important. And I think that it's especially important now because we're more aware of that. And we're also at a crossroads in music where we have programs that aren't getting as much engagement as they did maybe 15 or 20 years ago. And I wonder sometimes if that's because we're not teaching to the students that we have. We're teaching to this ideal that was our experience maybe as music students. So I think that in some ways we need to reconsider how do we engage those students so that we can revitalize those programs and make sure that all of our students are getting what they need.
Mm-hmm. We'll definitely circle back to that question soon. But let's go into understanding the student. What are some common ways that neurodivergence, so a huge umbrella term, let's break that down a little bit, ADHD, autism, some learning differences, etc., shows up in the music classroom or in the classroom?
So there are lots of different ways that it might show up. And like you said, it is a large umbrella. And even mm-hmm. if we break it down within those smaller sectors, you're still going to have different behaviors.
So much more.
Yeah. But some of the ways that I've seen this happen are things like sound sensitivities. So you have people who can't take particularly loud sounds mm-hmm. or maybe have difficulties engaging with different sounds or don't like particular textures. Another thing might be something like an understanding of timing. So you might have students who are really highly accurate in terms of timing, and it might really bother them if some of the other students in the class aren't like perfectly on the beat. You might have things like notation, reading difficulties, where some of your students might prefer learning by ear because that's a really strong point that they have. They're able to play by ear or mimic learning in that way. And then when we talk about ADHD, like there's the classic thing that we associate with that, which is like lack of focus or attention. Mm-hmm. There are different ways that you can deal with those, but those are some of the things that you might see in the classroom. But again, I don't think that those are necessarily specific to so-called neurodivergent individuals.
Definitely.
Sometimes that happens with any of the students that you might have in the class.
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up. I think it's important to be aware of these characteristics that have to do with some concepts of neurodivergence, but it's also important to remember that that doesn't necessarily mean a child is neurodivergent. You know, somebody could just have a short attention span, but that doesn't mean that they have ADHD.
Yeah, it might just mean that maybe they're bored with the task, and who doesn't get bored sometimes, right?
Exactly, yeah, for sure. On that note, you were mentioning that some students prefer to learn by ear, or some students are super on the beat. So what are some strengths that neurodivergent students often bring to music learning, maybe pertaining to those, and how could we use those for their success?
Well, I think that those are strengths too. To be able to learn by ear is a special skill that not everybody has, myself included. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to mimic notes? My son has perfect pitch, and I'm jealous sometimes. I also think that it might be a burden, but I'm jealous sometimes that you can pick out those pitches and be able to mimic that so easily. So yeah, I think that that's a strength in some ways, but I can also see where that might be difficult to have this ability to hear things perfectly in tune and then understand that probably the rest of the class isn't going to be in tune, and that's going to be frustrating, right?
Yeah, it can be a superpower sometimes. I mean, not to say anything, I have perfect pitch as well.
Yeah.
And it feels nice in terms of like when your teacher or professor is like, oh, what note is that? What key is that? And you're like, I already know. But it can be a burden sometimes, like you're saying, especially in like an elementary or high school class and like grade 9, for instance, where not everybody has accomplished, per se, their instrument just yet. And it's like a bunch of craziness and everybody's like on different tunes. And it can be a lot sometimes because that really bothers you.
Yeah.
But definitely something that you could use as a tool for success, because it does have its advantages as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about when I was first learning my instrument, bringing it home and playing, you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb on my squeaky clarinet, and how proud I was and how it must have been awful for my parents. but yeah, I think that it could be leveraged as a positive because you have this student with this kind of super ability in the class. So if they're comfortable with it, maybe there's some sort of mentoring opportunity there where you could break off into groups and have them help others. If, again, if they're comfortable, it sort of depends on how they react to that. But there are lots of other strengths that you could see in this as well. There are things like pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So people who can pick out those patterns really easily are going to learn pieces more quickly because music is often organized in patterns, right? Mm-hmm. You have repeated choruses, you have different melodies that might come back over time. So if you can point that out, it becomes kind of a game. Like, oh, I can recognize those patterns, and then it's really quick to learn. You could also offer different opportunities for creativity. So there are always extension opportunities that you can give in classes where often people who are labeled as neurodivergent tend to see things in different ways. And maybe that looks creative. Maybe that looks like something that you or some of the other students didn't think of. So opportunities for using that creativity and that way of seeing music a little bit differently. And then, like I said, you could assign different roles, have peer help, small group leadership, so you're breaking people into groups. And maybe that means putting people with similar strengths together, or maybe that means having some of your weaker learners in a group with somebody who's stronger in that aspect and giving them that leadership opportunity mm-hmm. so that they're strengthening different kinds of skills.
Mm-hmm. It gives opportunity for the person who might be stronger in the aspect to build on that strength. For me personally, I find that when I'm given a moment to talk about something that I'm strong at, it makes me even stronger in the subject because I have to teach it and I have to analyze it while making sure that somebody else understands. So that not only strengthens their understanding of the concept, but mine as well, because I tend to say things that I hadn't previously thought about because I'm trying to adhere to their learning strategies. But then it makes me see it from a different perspective, and then I gain more understanding of the concept. So yeah, definitely useful for both the learner and the instructor in that scenario.
You're going to have students who have different experiences. So you might have people who are stronger in certain skills because they have more experience. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that they're necessarily a stronger or weaker student, but just maybe they grasp that concept quicker, or maybe they have lessons outside of class that has given them more experience. So yeah, thinking about how different people have different skill sets, because everybody's stronger at something and weaker at others, I find. Mm-hmm. Just putting those things together, I think, can be helpful. But like you said, there's that old adage, you know, the best way to learn something is to teach it, right? If you can explain it to somebody else,
yeah,
then you're going to understand it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I find that that's very true. All right. Well, let's take a break and we will come back and talk about teaching approaches and adaptations to understanding the student. We are back and we're going to be talking about teaching approaches and adaptations for neurodivergent students in the music classroom. We're here with Dr. Cheryl Bruce and Gigi from CFRC Radio. Dr. Bruce, how do you adapt lesson structure for students with different attention spans or sensory needs?
Well, there are lots of different ways you can do it, and I suppose it kind of depends on the activity that you're doing. But I think for most learners, because as I said, I think it's important to really consider everyone as individuals. I think for most learners, it's important to offer different types of learning experiences. Mm-hmm. So you're not coming to class and doing the exact same thing every day. Having said that, I think that for particular learners, it's really important to have some sort of routine in place. So, you know, we always come in and we do a warm-up, or we do like a
technique,
or maybe it's just a question that gets everybody sort of having a conversation at the beginning of class. Mm-hmm. So they know that, okay, this is my mind's on kind of activity. Now I'm ready to learn. And then you have your big lesson in the middle. So I think for a lot of learners, it's important to break things down so that you're not, if we're talking about high school, for example, you're not spending 75 minutes doing the exact same thing, because I don't know about you, but I don't think I could concentrate for 75 minutes
no,
on one thing.
It's too much.
Yeah. So just making sure that you're breaking things down so that it's not chaotic, but so that you have some different options over the course of the class. Mm-hmm. And then using the word options, I think when it comes to assignments, thinking about the learners that you have in the classroom, what's the best way that they can demonstrate their learning? For some people, that's going to be a performance opportunity. It's going to be maybe a written assignment. Maybe it's going to be a recording or a video or something creative. As a teacher, you're sort of like beholden to the curriculum. You do have to be able to check off, yes, I taught this and this and this. But there are different ways that you can do that. So I think having options for your different learners is really important to think about how they can demonstrate that learning. And that's going to depend on who you have in your class. So the best advice I can give for that is get to know your learners right mm-hmm. away. Get to know them at the beginning of the year. Have conversations with them. Observe what's going on in the classroom and what their strengths are and what they maybe don't particularly like doing. And that's not to say that sometimes they're probably going to have to do things that they don't love, but you also have to be aware that when it comes to demonstrating learning, when it comes to marks, they should have the option to do that in a way that's comfortable for them mm-hmm. and that best represents their learning. Mm-hmm. So if they're really, really nervous playing in front of the class, that's not going to show them at their optimal best. But mm-hmm. if you know that they can do that, maybe you give them a mark based on your observations, or maybe that's a private performance just for you mm-hmm. and they can still demonstrate those skills. So yeah, I think it really just sort of depends on your learners and getting to know them and what they need individually, and then adapting your lessons and options accordingly.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I know that a lot of my friends, I wouldn't say suffer, but do have performance anxiety. And obviously in the music classroom, that's something that you're going to have to do at one point or another. But I do like that option. And I remember my high school teacher also made this an option. You could do your test or some sort of performance either in front of the classroom or privately. That way you could actually showcase your specialties as opposed to being anxious and not quite doing as well as you could if it were just a one-on-one thing. So I do appreciate that you brought that up. Are there any specific practice techniques or like classroom management techniques that work particularly well for neurodivergent students?
Again, I think it really sort of depends on who your learners are. So I think, as I said before, routine is really important.
Mm-hmm.
For me, in the classes that I've taught, what I've found is treating every day as a new day is also really important. So I've known people in the past who form opinions about certain students, and that tends to follow them through school. And things happen. And, you know, teenagers are still developing. Children are still developing. That's not their personality. It could just be that they didn't get enough sleep. It could be that they didn't have something to eat that morning. You never know what's going on in their lives. So to me, every day was a new day. If something happened the day before, we come back the next day, we say good morning, and we go from there. That's not to say that you don't deal with behaviors as they come, but you also can't hold that against your students. And mm-hmm. I think that that's really important. And I know that doesn't sound like classroom management on the surface, but creating those connections is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a grudge against a student and that shows from day to day, that connection's no longer there, that respect is no longer there, why would they listen to you if they don't respect you, right? So yeah, I think that building those relationships and thinking of your students as individual people who have lives outside of school, just as they need to think about you in the same way, is really important.
I like that you brought that up, making connections. I'm a piano teacher, and I used to have a student who, in my opinion, was definitely neurodivergent. He wasn't diagnosed as far as I know. And something that really worked with us is that we had a great connection. He could tell me absolutely anything and I would never bat an eye, but that made our relationship really trustworthy that he could tell me anything. And also it really worked for us because he could ask me anything without feeling judged. I think sometimes that can be a really big issue from teacher to student. And you feel like if you're going to ask a question, oh my gosh, is this a stupid question? Maybe I shouldn't ask it. But as a teacher and as a student, you need to ask questions. That's how you learn. And so making connections is really, really important, especially with neurodivergent students, but with all students in general.
Yeah.
You were talking about how sometimes people hold grudges and bring something day to day, even though we think that that shouldn't be an issue. So what misconceptions do teachers or music teachers often have about neurodivergent students?
Well, I definitely think that there's this idea that anybody who's quote unquote different, who's been labeled with something, is therefore harder to work with, which means that they're not going to be able to meet your expectations in the classroom. It's going to be harder to teach them. It's going to be more work for the teacher to adapt those lessons. I think that those are not true because, again, you could have any student who might need adaptations. You could have any student who comes to class with some sort of baggage that may make them not be able to engage that day. And you as a teacher then need to be able to pivot and think about, okay, well, maybe today isn't going to be a good day for learning, or maybe I can present it in a different way. I can give this student a little bit of grace. So I think that it's really just about respect, and as I said, getting to know your students. And as a teacher, it's about adaptability and being able to be creative on the spot. You're not always going to get it perfect. You're not always going to have the best lesson ever, and you also kind of need to be okay with that. But I think that there's a lot of fear when people go into teaching about, I'm not going to be able to deal with these things that come up with students who maybe don't fit into my own experience. Because as teachers, we've often gone through sort of the ideal situation, right? Like we've taken private music lessons, we've gone to university, and then we often have the idea that when we go back into the classroom, it's going to be a classroom filled with people who've had that same experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that you might have one student who's going to take that path that particular year. You need to be aware of how to present things differently and just meet your students where they are, I think, is the most important thing.
Yeah, actually, I was just talking about this yesterday. I'm a strong believer that I think it's a mindset. I think there's often times where teachers might go into a situation thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going into this situation where there's 8 kids with ADHD, 1 kid with autism in the class. This is going to be too much for me. This is going to be a strenuous day. And that's a valid thought to have. But what if we just alter that a little bit? Like, okay, yes, I have 8 students with ADHD in this class, and yes, there's one more student with autism in this class, but what can this experience teach me, and how is this experience going to make me a better teacher for the future? I think it's all about mindset.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. It's definitely about mindset, and we have to be aware of our mindset going in and be able to change that to a more positive mindset, I think. Mm-hmm. I taught a guitar class. It was a 10, 11, 12 guitar class, which is pretty common.
Because, a lot, though.
Yeah, it is a lot. It's a lot to think about and adapt for. I think I had about 32 students in that class, and of the 32 students, I had 15 IEPs. So that sounds overwhelming, right? But I think this is the problem. You look at that from a distance and go, oh my goodness. And I did too when I first got that assignment, because you get the paperwork and you get your assignment before you actually meet the students. And so mm-hmm. you get in your head and you go, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this? How am I going to adapt for all of these learners? How am I going to make sure that I have material for both 10 and 11, 12 classes. I also had students from school to community who came into that class as enrichment, I guess, who ended up being such an asset to the class. So mm-hmm. it was not what I expected it to be based on the assignment. Mm-hmm. So I think it's hard to do this because everybody's going to look at that and go, what do I do? Mm-hmm. But you kind of have to reserve judgment until you get into the class, you meet your students, and that's where the real planning starts to happen. Of course, you have an idea of what you're going to do over the course of the year or the semester or whatever the case may be. But it's really not until you meet those students that you can fully understand what that's going to look like. So once I met the students, it was like, okay, these students are great. We can work with this. We can figure out, you know, what engages them, what makes them want to be here. And, you know, not every day is going to be perfect, but I had to switch my own mindset and go, okay, if I look at this from a different perspective, if I look at this with a sense of curiosity rather than trepidation, that's completely going to change how I approach the class, which in turn changes how those students react to me, right? If I'm there with positivity and curiosity and wanting to engage with them rather than my back is already up and I don't know how I'm going to deal with this, mm-hmm. your students feel that too. Your students feel that sort of connection.
Yeah,
right?
They definitely get the energy.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's about how you set that energy in the classroom, mm-hmm. how you think about your mindset as you go into it. And then I know this is hard to do, but try not to worry until you actually have something to worry about. Because mm-hmm. often we come up with things that are not going to be issues at all.
Yeah, and going back to the positive mindset, like, I know the first way that I reacted to was like, oh my gosh, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. But immediately after, I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, that must have been such a learning experience for you. And I always like to think about it that way as well. Whenever I have tough situations like that, how much of a learning experience it's going to be. And then not only that, afterwards, everything that I will have gained and how much of a better teacher I will be because of that experience. Because I cannot imagine teaching 3 grades, 31, 32?
I think it was 32. Yeah.
32 kids. Insane. None of them are the same age. That's a lot. But you gain a lot from that experience. So I think that's another way to change the mindset.
Yeah. You gain a lot of experience as a teacher, and you get to see that spark in your students that mm-hmm. that is why we do this thing that we do, right? And yeah, you're not going to get that back from everyone. But even if you have 5 students or 10 students that are really happy to be there, and I was really lucky that the whole class was great. Not everybody was necessarily happy to be there, but there wasn't one student that I couldn't find something positive about, that I couldn't yeah. make some sort of connection with. And I think that's what matters.
If you can make a difference even in a small area, that's already enough, I find too.
Yeah.
Let's switch the topic a little bit to working with parents. I once had a student who I believe was neurodivergent, but he wasn't diagnosed as far as I know. And so I had to alter the way that I communicated with him and that I did lesson plans for him. But I am working towards my degree, right? And so it was difficult for me to say anything to his parents who were in very impressive and successful careers.
Oh, wow.
To say something like, hey, I think this, you know? So in a situation like that, what do you think are some sensitive ways to discuss learning differences with families?
Well, I mean, I don't think that sense of like, what do I say to parents ever goes away, because even as a teacher, you're not an expert in medicine. I can't diagnose these students, and often they don't come to you diagnosed, and that really shouldn't matter, I suppose. But it's important to know that it's not up to you to do that. Mm-hmm. So when you're communicating with parents, that really can't be part of the conversation. So you try to keep it as positive as possible. You have to think of these conversations as collaboration. The parents want the best for their kid, and you as their teacher presumably want the best for them as well, right? Mm-hmm. So we're working together towards the same goal. And I think if you approach it from that kind of perspective, I sort of think that's the best way to do it. Positivity is always good. You also want to avoid judgment. So you don't want to say something like, you know, Johnny can't handle this, or Johnny can't do this particular thing. It's more like, I've noticed these behaviors. Do you have any suggestions about how to deal with this, perhaps? Or, you know, I've noticed that this student is having difficulty with this particular aspect. Again, like, do you have any insight into this? Do you notice this at home? How do you deal with this? Yeah, so you can share your observations. I would also start with strengths, because parents always want to know what their children do well, right? Yeah. They're proud of them. That's the first thing they want to see. So, you know, your student is really great at
XYZ.
Yeah. Playing by ear, or whatever the case may be. And I'm really proud of them for doing that. They've moved forward leaps and bounds in these particular things. But I would like to see more growth in this area. Let's work together to try and make that happen, or, you know, ask for suggestions. You could also describe what happened in the lesson. Here are the strategies that I've given to your child to work on at home. If that's something that, you know, you feel that you could support, or we can talk about strategies to work on it. So it should be a back and forth conversation rather than a one-sided, this is what I see, this is what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that we're talking about this, because as someone who's going to be a future teacher, I think working with the parents is one of my biggest concerns, because it's not quite something that you get taught in school. Like, here are strategies and structures to go about parent-teacher interviews or conferences. These are some things that you should mention first. You should talk about strengths first, then you should talk about what they need to work on. You know, I feel like that's something that's not talked about, so I'm glad that we're doing that.
I mean, that's very true. We don't really talk about that, and it's an important aspect of teaching, because our students' parents should be our partners in this endeavor. And I will say that, unfortunately, that's not always the case. So you do have to be aware of that, too. But always keep your professional sort of attitude. And if you start the conversation on a positive note, it's much more likely to end on a positive note than if you start on a negative, like, here are the behaviors that I'm seeing. And I would say that's true even if you're calling home about, like, a concern from school, right? Say something about the connection that you've made with the student, or something good that's happened in the classroom, if you possibly can. And I think that's a much better way to get the parent on side. Because again, everything's about relationships. Everything's about these social connections that we don't really think about. We tend to think of teaching as clinical activity sometimes, but we're all human, and we all want to know that our kids are doing well. And I think most teachers feel the same. You want your students to do well too. So I think in some aspects, parents sometimes think teachers are the enemy if they're of that mindset. Mm-hmm. You know, the teacher is the one who's responsible for passing my kid or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you want to let them know that you're human as well. Like, I care about your kid. I want them to do well, but there needs to be some give and take here. There needs to be a partnership. Let's work on this together.
Mm-hmm. I've been in situations where the parent takes feedback more like an attack, and then the conversation becomes kind of negative.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of tips do you think you could give for that?
If I look at this from like a school perspective, as soon as you're calling home, the parent automatically thinks that something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one way to make sure that that doesn't happen is to start communication early. The first communication that the parent has from you shouldn't be something negative. Mm-hmm. So if you're teaching a class, maybe at the beginning of the year, you send an email home or a letter home and introduce yourself and say, like, I'm really excited to work with your kid, right? So I think that's one way to do it. Then, like I said, when you're having a conversation, to start out on a positive note. Unfortunately, sometimes people interpret things in a way that we don't mean for them to. So if that happens, because it will at some point in time.
You can never gauge when it's going to happen. Sometimes it just does and you're not really ready for it. But here's some tips so that you will be.
Yeah, right. So if it does happen, I guess it depends on the situation. If you're teaching private lessons, maybe you try to bring the conversation back on track and then afterwards, you send a note home and just say, like, it was nice to speak to you today. Thank you for having that conversation. Just to reiterate, these are the points that I was trying to make and try to spin it in sort of a positive way. If it's happening in a school, I would do the same. I would maybe follow up, but I would also communicate with my admin and say, hey, this happened today, just so you know, because chances are if a parent's upset, their next step is going to be to go to admin, mm-hmm. right? So just being honest about what happened in that conversation, what happened in that class, so that they're aware and they're not blindsided by this same sort of attack can be helpful, because then your admin can sort of think through how they're going to deal with it if they are contacted as well, mm-hmm. and try to mitigate that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift our focus a little bit to equity and access. Do you think traditional music education systems are inclusive of neurodivergent learners?
Well, I think it really depends on the context. Mm-hmm. If we look at traditional models of learning, I don't know, in a conservatory space, maybe not, because there are very rigid expectations. You know, if you look at like Royal Conservatory expectations, for example, you have these set lists of music that you have to learn and set mm-hmm. technique that you have to learn. And there isn't a lot of
wiggle
movement.
Room.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So I would say in that respect, it's not necessarily set up for everyone, because you're not going to reach every learner with music that they're necessarily engaged with music that they love. I think choice is really important in that. I think there's a little bit of wiggle room now with Royal Conservatory. Like, there are alternate lists that you can choose from, but it's
yes.
still a little bit, like, rigid.
I agree. I definitely had that issue when I was doing RCM as well, where there would just be so many pieces that we could choose from, but none of them was quite to my liking. And as of recently, they do have an alternative list that's a little bit more, I think, pop songs that they offer, which I, for one, really do appreciate, because that really speaks to me more than other options. I also think that it depends, if we're talking about the classroom, it depends where you're situated. I think in more rural areas, there's less access to resources because you're in a rural area, whereas somewhere in Toronto, for instance, in like an art school that's dedicated to music, drama, the arts, would have more resources to include all learners. So for example, in my high school, well, if we're talking about what we did and didn't have, we didn't have a lot of things. our instruments were constantly out of tune. Our instruments were constantly broken. And this isn't just for neurodivergent learners. This is for the music classroom in general. It wasn't amazing, but I think if you were to go more towards the city, it would be, and there would be more resources, or something that's a little bit more specific for neurodivergent learners. I think there could be more resources in that. I recently found of not noise canceling, but noise reducing headphones. I think that could be very helpful in a music classroom. Maybe not when you're actually performing and trying to listen to each other, but in a moment where everybody's practicing, that could definitely be helpful. What do you think about that?
Yeah, if you're talking about adaptive technology, I think you're right that larger centers are going to have more access to resources. That's not to say that they're necessarily going to have everything that you need, but mm-hmm. more likely to.
Definitely.
But I don't think that adaptability necessarily means technology. I think that we are better equipped and will be better equipped in the future as individual educators to deal with differences. And I think that it's more based on individual preference than anything. It doesn't have to be technology. It's more about, can I be creative in how this is presented to the class? Can I be adaptable in the moment? And that comes with experience. A first-year teacher might be really great at it, but it takes time and it takes experience to learn those kinds of things. And so I think it's more about context and experience and willingness to adapt more so than technology. Technology is great and it can help, but I think it has to start with the educator themselves.
So then on that note, how do you think studios, teachers can make their learning environments more welcoming to everyone in general or specifically to neurodivergent students?
Well, I think thinking about access for everyone is important. So looking at universal design for learning standards, like how can I ensure that everybody has access to what they need, not just people who've been identified as, you know, needing an IEP or identified as being neurodivergent, but how do I make my classroom welcoming to everyone and honor the fact that everybody is different and comes to this with different resources and experiences and interests and all of that kind of thing. So thinking about that as you set up your classroom right at the beginning of the year, because you're probably not going to know all of your students. If you've been in the school for a while, if this is a school environment, you might know some of them, but you're going to have new students. One of the things that you can do if it's an upper year class is to talk to other teachers who've had those students and say, you know, what can you tell me about this person? So what do they need? Yeah. Maybe that looks like leaving space for accessibility in the classroom so your chairs aren't too close together. Maybe that means making sure that the equipment that you're using isn't like super loud on the first day so that it's not overwhelming and the room isn't really noisy. Maybe that looks like putting up welcoming posters that represent different people who are going to be in your class in terms of culture and background and all of that kind of stuff so that they're not coming into this classroom that's overwhelmingly like Western classical music, but it's, you know, I recognize the fact that you might have other interests or you might be coming from a different background and we want you to feel included too. So I think just sort of like setting that standard before your students come in is really important. And then just sort of getting to know your students over the course of the year and adapting as necessary. So a student says to you, I need a little bit more space around me. I'm feeling really crowded or whatever. So not waiting until the next day to do that or the next week, but making sure that they have that space they need if you can accommodate for it right away. So, you know, having those conversations, recognizing what your students need and then adapting for it, and they can see you doing that, I think also creates that respect because you're honoring what they need in that moment.
I think it's really important to shine a light on comfortability. The more a student feels comfortable in your classroom, whether that's with your teaching methods or physically comfortable, the more they'll be interested and want to learn, and then you'll see results from there for sure. So as we're nearing the end of the program, let's do a little bit of reflection. What changes would you like to see in music education in the next 5 to 10 years?
I would like to see teachers who feel comfortable coming into a classroom where you have 30 students and all 30 of those students are different and need different things. And I think right now, a lot of teachers who come into the profession feel a lot of anxiety because they feel unprepared. And I think we need to have more of these conversations. I would like to see learning communities set up for teachers so that you don't feel alone in the classroom. You don't have to come up with all of the answers yourself. You have colleagues in the school who probably know your students because they've taught them before or have had similar experiences and can offer advice or even just a shoulder to lean on, somebody to talk to so that you don't feel siloed in that music classroom. It's not just you, but you're part of a community. Classroom management is a big one that I think a lot of people would benefit from conversations about because
definitely
I see a lot of anxiety about that. Yeah. So just knowing that you have other people to go to. And then for students, I think it looks like feeling comfortable in the classroom. So as you said, I think comfort is really important, but I also think that music is one of those spaces where we have the ability to adapt for that. We often have fairly large classrooms, which means we can spread out a little bit. And we also have this diversity in terms of how and what we teach. So it's possible to adapt quite easily with a little bit of creativity. So I'd like to see more of that, of that honoring of how music can look different based on who's in your classroom and what they need.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have one last question for you. Having been a high school teacher and now an adjunct professor, you know your stuff in education, you know your stuff in music. I would say you've been through it all and you have quite extensive knowledge on the subject. What is something that you would like the listeners to take from today, if only one thing?
If only one thing? I think approaching anything we do as teachers, as musicians, as humans, with a sense of curiosity is really important. That's how we learn, and that's how we grow, and that's how we make connections with people, and that's how we get excited about things. And curiosity over negativity always is really important.
So change the mindset to wanting to have new experiences and learn new things from them.
Exactly. Yeah.
Perfect. Well said. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We truly appreciate your time, insights, and the valuable perspectives you shared with us. Today, we explored the challenges and strategies in working with neurodivergent students, specifically in the music classroom, with the incredible insights from Dr. Cheryl Bruce. So, what can we learn from our discussion? Supporting neurodivergent students in the music classroom means recognizing and valuing diverse ways of learning, communicating, and expressing creativity. By adapting our approaches, whether through differentiated instruction, sensory-aware environments, or student-centered strategies, we can create spaces where all learners feel seen, supported, and empowered to succeed. Ultimately, it reminds us that inclusive teaching is not an added component, but a fundamental part of effective and meaningful music education. Once again, a heartfelt shout out and appreciation to Dr. Cheryl Bruce for sharing her expertise, and thank you all for tuning in. Find us on social media at CFRC Music on Instagram to continue the conversation and stay updated on future takeovers. You're listening to Gigi on CFRC Radio, and from me to you, have the best week ever, be safe, be kind, and I'll catch you in the classroom.
get to. So come on, play it how I do. No, every kiss should leave a scar too. Don't you know every kiss should leave a scar?
Transplant Advocate Association invites you to celebrate Be a Donor Month this April. Be a Donor Month brings awareness to the need for organ and tissue donation in Ontario and inspires people who are not currently registered to do so. In addition, April 7th is designated as Green Shirt Day across Canada in honor of Humboldt Broncos hockey player Logan Boulay, who saved six lives after he and several of his teammates perished in a bus crash in 2018. Logan's story encouraged more than 150,000 Canadians to register their intent to donate their organs. In celebration of Be a Donor Month and Green Shirt Day on April 7th, TAA invites the general public to flag raising and proclamation ceremony at Napanee Administration offices at 11 a.m. or in Kingston at Confederation Park in front of City Hall at 5 p.m. Town and city officials will be in attendance at both events, and the public can take the opportunity to